I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Rachel Dolezal sat down with the Today Show Matt Lauer yesterday to answer questions about her racial identity. For years, she had claimed that she was black while she did advocacy work on civil rights issues, including as head of the Spokane, Washington NAACP. Her white parents outed her last week. She resigned from the organization, has faced a barrage of questions, and kicked up a contentious debate over racial identity. Here's what she told Matt Lauer.
Are you an African-American woman?
I identify as black.
You identify as black. Let me put a picture up of you in your early 20s, though. Mm-hmm. And when you see this picture, is this an African-American woman or is that a Caucasian woman?
That's not in my early 20s, but...
That's a little younger, I guess.
Yeah. I think I was 16 in that picture.
Is she a Caucasian woman or an African-American woman?
I would say that visibly she would be identified as white by people who see her.
But at the time, were you identifying yourself as African-American?
In that picture, during that time, no.
Today on Radio Times, what to make of Rachel Dolezal and her claim of blackness and the debate her comments have created about the definition of race and racial identity. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Dr. Yaba Blay is a professor of Africana Studies at Drexel University, author of a book that came out a couple of years ago, One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. She was a consulting producer for the CNN documentary series Black in America, and she was a consulting producer for a segment called Who is Black in America? And Yaba Blay, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us, James Peterson. He's director of Africana Studies, associate professor of English at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and thegrio.com, and he's the host of the Remix podcast that you can hear at WHYY and Newsworks. And James Peterson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. Is this an important conversation to have?
It is an important conversation to have. I'm not sure if we're having the right set or series of conversations, and I think it's frustrating for some of us who want to continue this national conversation about race to have it centered on Rachel Dolezal, because, you know, I want to be talking about Jerrya Becton and Tamir Rice and some of the other issues and challenges that we're facing in the Black Lives Matter movement, but obviously the news cycle dictates the ways in which we can have certain kinds of conversations.
What about for you, Yaba?
I would agree with what James is saying, but I also think it's an opportunity for us to check ourselves about which stories make us interested in race and why. And so he's absolutely right in terms of our attention or the lack of attention that we give to the Black Lives Matter movement, but we're more comfortable having this conversation about this white woman impersonating blackness.
And why do you think that is?
I think it's that kind of scandal that comes with
gets
passing.
Gets people all fired up?
Absolutely. I think we've always been fascinating by the phenomenon of passing. Like, how do people do it and why do people do it? But in this case, it's happening in the quote-unquote reverse, right? And I think that has a lot to do with the reality that because blackness is so denigrated in the media and in our realities, why would anyone who doesn't have to be black, quote-unquote, choose to be black?
Which is an interesting question. I mean, she, going back to her herself, James Peterson, she has chosen this, at least temporarily.
She has, and I think one of the problems for me about the conversation is that this is revolves so much around blackness. What is blackness? And it forces or is challenging black folks to define what blackness is, and particularly for black women, what being a black woman means. And really, the conversation should be about whiteness.
Absolutely.
This is about whiteness. And it's about the trade-off that white folks make in terms of their own ethnicities. And so there are a number of different white ethnicities in America, Italian, Jewish, Polish, Irish, right? And the reality is that most white folks take a certain sort of trade-off. They say, we're going to be white, and we will sort of exchange our ethnic background for whiteness. And so when Dolezal is talking about isolation and searching for identity, she should be searching for her white identity. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we can celebrate a wide range of identities, but this is really a problem and a discussion that should be centered on whiteness instead of it being about, like, what is blackness and trying to challenge sort of what the authenticity of blackness is.
Absolutely.
What questions would you want to ask her? We were actually talking about the two interviews before we went on the air, the pros and the cons. But if you could have interviewed her, Yaba Blay, what would you have asked her?
I think I would have pushed back on a lot of the rhetoric that she's putting forth about her identity. I think she's skating around the issues. I would probably want a clear answer about how she defines her blackness, because if you listen to the Matt Lauer interview, he says African-American, she says black.
Right.
Let's have a conversation about what those two terms mean for you and how it is that black is something that you can then approach. I would also, as a black woman, want to sit face-to-face with her and have her explain to me how, insofar as she believes that she's doing the quote-unquote work, right, and that she's a social justice activist, how does she make peace with the fact that what she's doing ultimately continues to marginalize me, the very person who she claims to identify with?
Are you insulted by her?
In many ways. I can, you know, it's tricky, right? When the story broke, and Friday, of course, social media was pure comedy day. So, you know, all kinds
it's
of
It's an everyday comedy day for social media.
The hashtags are classic on this one.
The hashtags, the memes, you know. We had a lot of jokes at her expense, of course, and of course, lots of people want to talk about it. And at first, I was like, okay, yes, let's have this conversation. Let's talk about it. And then after some time, the fact that people are still very much consumed by this story, the offense comes at the idea that we are really distracted in a particular way.
Mm-hmm.
And we're losing sight of so many other issues that are happening that are related to blackness. And we're participating in this circus that it's allowing us to stay distracted in a certain way.
Do you think it undoes, I don't know what her sincerity is, but clearly living as a black person, she has done some advocacy work. If you read what she said and a little bit that I know about the Spokane, Washington NAACP, there are more people that belong to it, in part because she headed it up. Does it discredit her work for civil rights?
Well, it
whatever it is?
It discredits the identity that she claims to have had in doing that work. The work stands on its own in some ways. I mean, there's a way in which she could have done everything that she refers to as her work as a white woman. And in many ways, white allies are much more important than white folks trying to appropriate black culture or black identity. So she needs to sort of check herself in evaluating that. Some of the follow-up questions I would have loved to have asked was,
sure,
when she makes the comment that she doesn't want her own identity or what she's dealing with to sort of outstrip what the movement is, she's got to look at this moment and understand how her story, her narrative, is dominating media and detracting from a very, very momentous Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, just in the context of her own estimation of herself and her relationship to what she calls social justice movements, her story has overshadowed more important stories that we need to be talking about right now. So in that sense, she should check out just on that alone. I would also want to follow up with her about her rationale in terms of claiming blackness based upon a relationship she has with her adopted children,
right,
because there have been so many white mothers, including Melissa Harris Perry's own mom, who have raised black children. That does not in any way legitimate her appropriation of a black identity, in my opinion.
Right.
You said right.
Yeah, because I would want to have a conversation about privilege. Because to me, this is the ultimate reflection of white privilege.
That,
right?
You can choose.
That you can do whatever you want. Because, and James is right, this conversation, when we say race, we're so quick to talk about blackness and brownness and all the other quote-unquote colors, but race was created to protect whiteness. So why are we not talking about whiteness? Whiteness is fixed. That's like a simple, understood truth. We don't check it. We don't talk about it. Now we want to talk about blackness perhaps being malleable. Why aren't we talking about whiteness? So I want to talk to her about, you know, this being a reflection of her white privilege, that she can actually do whatever she wants to do and essentially tell us all to mind our business.
Mm, interesting. Let me pick up on the book that you wrote. I interviewed you about the book a couple of years ago when it came out, and you interviewed something like 60 people who identified as black, and they called themselves, I mean, in many ways, they would. Some of them would pass on the street. You would pass them and think, that's not an African-American person. And they called themselves black, biracial. There was an Appalachian African-American in the book. There was a black Latina. There was a Jamaican in the book as well. She at times called herself transracial, Rachel. Can people call themselves these things? Can we self-identify?
Well,
legitimately?
I think there are a lot of things going on, and it's interesting because this case really did make me kind of flip back through the book, right? Because there are a lot of women in the book who actually look similar to Rachel Dolezal in terms of phenotype. I think for me, the thing that makes the stories different, beyond the fact that there is perhaps some genetic reality to their blackness, if there is such a thing, is the fact that people are just being, right? So it's one of those things where now looking back, so if we look at Rachel Dolezal's Instagram and we look at some of the things that she's said and done, now we can see it, right, that there's this overperformance of blackness that's completely seated in this narrative of oppression. And for so many people in the book, for myself included, for so many other quote-unquote real black people, our identity is so much broader than just the oppression that we face. And it seems like Dolezal is completely hinged to this notion of oppression making her black.
Oh, and about survival and suffering. Yeah.
It's the exoticization of a particular kind of black experience. We don't want to discount the struggle and the oppression and the racism and the challenges that particularly black women face. You know, I've said this before, but they are the most hated and also the most imitated in our society. What I mean by that is when you look at any sort of metric in sort of sociology of America, black women suffer quite a bit in our society. But when you look at pop culture, when you look at media, black women are imitated and denigrated often in that imitation. And so that's why it's hard to disassociate Rachel Dolezal's behavior from that imitation sort of narrative that we see. And the fact that she's so much cloaking herself in the sort of narratives of victimology. And you can see it in social media. You can see it in how she sort of has been delivering these interviews. She's speaking about a very limited sense of what the experience is. And this is, again, the challenge. The black experience is broad. It does sort of encompass a wide range of American experiences and different identities. But you can't appropriate those experiences without disrespecting the narratives of the particular history with which we're talking about.
Right. She said, to Matt Lauer, I identify as black. She didn't say identify with black causes or black identity, but she used as.
She equates her experience with blackness. And for me, I think that's a question that keeps spinning in my head, like this idea that you wake up and quote unquote feel black. What does that mean?
Is she now white?
Is she white?
Is she white now?
I mean, I don't know what she is now.
Well, I think we should distinguish between African-American and black. And so the reason why she sort of walks away from the camera when the African-American question comes up is because that does go to a specific kind of phenotype and has a specific attachment to the history of slavery and a certain set of sort of easily definable experiences, or not easily, but definable experiences within an American and a transatlantic context. Black is a broader term. It encompasses African-Americans and Caribbean African-Americans and all sorts of black folk all over the world. And so I think for her, it's easier to sort of insert herself into that broader black narrative. And listen, the reasons why we talk about race as a social construct and the reasons why we try to think critically about what social constructions mean, they have very real consequences and very real experiences that attach to the social construction of it. But the reality is that the biological basis for race is almost non-existent. Right. It's like 0.1%. What we think of as like skin type and hair and all those things represent a very, 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 very minuscule percentage of what the human genome is. And so we're all much more alike than we are different. But the social construction of race still has very serious consequences. So when she is a teenager as a white woman in Montana, she's not confronted with what the consequences of the social construction of blackness is in America. And so being able to move in and out of that, that fluidity that she's claiming, I think does two things. One, it lies the conversation about whiteness that we have to have and the trade-off that white folks make with their own ethnicity to participate in the supremacy of whiteness in America. And then it diminishes what the black experience is and can be for those folk who live it for their entire lives.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's James Peterson, who joins us along with Yaba Blay. We are talking about the curious case of Rachel Dolezal. This is the white woman who's been passing for black and has raised a whole host of questions about racial identity. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and I see the phones are ringing at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Talking with James Peterson and Yaba Blay about the curious case of Rachel Dolezal. You probably had never heard of her a week ago, but now, of course, she's all over the news, a woman who claimed to be black and was out frankly, by her parents for being white. And I do want to play another clip from the interview with Matt Lauer that she had yesterday. And Matt Lauer was quoting from Jonathan Capehart, who said in a piece that he wrote in the Washington Post, blackface remains highly racist no matter how down with the cause a white person is. Matt Lauer asked her about that quote, and this is what she said.
This is not some freak birth of a nation mockery blackface performance. This is on a very real connected level. How I've actually had to go there with the experience, not just a visible representation, but with the experience. And the point at which that really solidified was when I got full custody of Isaiah. And he said, "You're my real mom." And he's in high school. And for that to be something that is plausible, I can, you know, certainly can't be seen as white and be Isaiah's mom.
And Isaiah is actually her stepbrother, adopted stepbrother. What she's saying, Yaba, is that I've experienced being black. Because I have said that I'm black, I have the experience of being black.
I don't know about that. I mean, she said I've actually had to go there with the experience. And, like, what does that mean? And the last statement that she made about it not being plausible of her being Isaiah's real mom and being white, that's nonsensical. I mean, this is someone who claimed a black man as her father, right? And they're not even anywhere nearly related. I think the blackface comment, though, is an important one. And I think for her saying that this isn't some freak of nature blackface Birth of a Nation performance, it doesn't have to be in order for it to be blackface, especially if we understand how racism becomes nuanced over time. In this moment, if we know the history of blackface, these minstrel performances was about white America poking fun, making caricatures out of black people, an exaggerated performance. It was blackness as access through a white lens. Is that not what she's doing? When, as a black woman, when I look at the images, right, of the hairstyles, some of her Instagram posts about, you know, I just baked a sweet potato pie for a new student. Like, you don't have to do all of that to be black, but that's what you witness blackness as being. So that's what you perform. And even if she wanted to do this, I've, you know, been down with the cause, or I've had these experiences in Spokane, where it's 2% black, or Idaho, like, which experiences have given you all of this insight into what blackness is? I'm confused by this.
And this is a profoundly anachronistic sense of what Birth of a Nation was as a film in this nation. It was an extremely popular and pervasive film. It was screened at the White House, the most popular film in the nation at the time in which it was made. It was taken as the book on record of what blackness post-Reconstruction was in the United States. And so to try to make it suggest that it's some freak, or that it didn't have authority, that it didn't have the sort of the backing of white supremacy and of Americanness behind it, is a misunderstanding of it. That's what blackface was. It comes out of a tradition of power and from a place of power. It's not some freak thing. It was America's first form of popular entertainment. Mm-hmm. And so she needs to understand that history. That's the history and experience that she's claiming as her intervention as a black woman, and she doesn't get it. You know, Rochelle Carey, who's a journalist, just tweeted out that we live in a country where the first black president has to produce his birth certificate to sort of identify himself, but a white woman can just come out and say she's black.
Ah, interesting, which is why you say this discussion really should be about whiteness, and I guess about white privilege, the ability to pick and choose your race in this case.
I think it would be a more accurate way of having the conversation. Right. And again, people are just, whiteness is unmarked, like Yaba is saying, it's so unmarked that people are not aware of that trade-off. There's a trade-off that white folks make all day, every day. And this is what caused the fragmentation, I think, in Rachel Dolezal's life. And so to sort of position that or impose that on blackness, to me, is just another form of white privilege.
Not to mention, right, if we want to actually take this, the misuse of transracial seriously, transracial would mean that I could come in this studio and sit before you and say that I'm a white woman and you take me seriously. I will never have access to the ability to choose my race is fixed. It was given to me. It's recognizable in a particular way. I don't have the option to choose something else and be taken seriously.
It just one also the whole I haven't the term transracial, as far as I know, has mostly been used in the discourses around adoption.
Absolutely.
It's
That's
about people
it, yes.
you know adopting outside or cross race, which is something she can claim, but she's sort of transferred that term into something that I think has more meaning for her in terms of appropriating the identity that she wants to appropriate.
I do want to get to the callers, and we got a lot of social media comments as well, but to you, Yaba. I was reading, I guess it was a Yale study that goes back almost 100 years, or I think more than 100 years, looking at African-American men at the end of the 19th century, beginning of 20th century, and something like 20% of them passing as white. I mean, passing has happens in this country, has happened, and obviously it's about that one, you know, that one drop rule.
Right. I think it's an interesting moment for us to even question this notion of passing, because it's really predicated on this idea that these boxes are fixed and we understand them and they're real, right? There's research that comes out of Penn State that says 30% of people who identify as white actually have three drops, three 30 seconds, Negro blood, if there is such a thing. And so there are a lot of white people, like whiteness isn't pure. But again, all of these boxes are predicated on the notion that it is, and we accept that and we move on. So there might be a whole lot of people passing if that is a phenomenon that we take seriously.
Sure. I mean, what's the takeaway from this, do you think, James?
Well, on the history of passing, we have to also understand what the predicament was of the folks who passed.
Sure.
Right? I mean, they lived in a world, and you could argue we still live in this world, where whiteness is valued more than blackness. And so a lot of those folks who were passing were folks who migrated north and were actually just trying to get jobs to earn money for their impoverished families. I mean, that's a very particular social justice racialized predicament. And passing comes out of a fraught history where people were committing suicide, people were disowned by their families, people were outed, people were killed for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very complicated and violent history. And so it almost is disrespectful to that history for us to claim that Rachel Dolezal is passing. Her passing is too cosmetic, and it's not as fraught and as crazy as that particular history. So again, the takeaway for me is for us to understand the unmarked nature of whiteness, the fluidity of whiteness, and the trade-off that white folks make in terms of their own ethnicities, because maybe we can start to have conversations about how people need to embrace their ethnic identities. I mean, maybe that's a more productive conversation for us to have instead of what it means to appropriate someone else's identity.
We have a comment from Richard who says, I don't think we can comment on this, but it's one that I was thinking about. Her story would be better covered by a discussion on the psychology of family dysfunction and personality disorders. I don't want to give her a label, but I think the more you sort of learn about her family, apparently there's been a gigantic rift in the family. Yeah. Her parents outed her last week.
I mean, on every media, on every source.
A parent, you know, one wonders why would a parent do that to a child? But nonetheless, there's clearly some things going on.
And again,
it's very sad.
We're choosing what we want to focus on. This is also a big story about deception, right?
Yes.
And we need to be checking her on that as well. But yeah, without doing the labeling, I think there are a lot of things going on.
Well, and I was reading some interviews with some people that had worked with her, I think at the NAACP, and for them it was personal. I mean, they knew her, and they thought she was a black woman, and she's not. And it felt personal. They felt lied to.
Of course, they should.
I don't know why I was staring at you like that. Let me get Mary from Pottstown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Mary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wonder in this discussion about race, you know, why it has to be defined by genetic or physical markers. I mean, we've seen that gender identity is not necessarily something that matches with what you're born with, and is something that it sometimes takes people a long time to understand how they're feeling about it, or why they feel differently about it, or why they feel so passionate about certain causes, until they eventually realize, hey, wait a minute, maybe what my body is defined as is not necessarily identifying me as a person. So I'm just, you know, and as I raise my children who are multiracial, like, I don't want them to be defined simply by the colors that make up their complexion. I want them to be defined as Rachel Dolezal's son said, as, mom, racially, you're human. You know, I want them to be a part of the human race. I don't want them to define themselves, and nor does my husband want them to define themselves as one race or another or anything like that.
Sure.
Why can't it be? How are they culturally? How do they identify? How do they feel as a human being inside?
Well, Mary,
I guess that's my question.
No, it's a good one. I'm going to toss that to you, James.
Yeah, I you know, I'm all for intersectionality, which is trying to have productive discourses at the intersections of race and gender and religion and class. And I think those are important things to have. But it doesn't mean we can't celebrate the distinctions and differences of certain identity categories. And so to conflate gender and race, I don't think is useful or productive here. And a lot of folks have tried to use the Caitlyn Jenner story as a story to validate Rachel Dolezal. But look at their narratives. Look at how they have arrived at where they have arrived. When Caitlyn Jenner was Bruce Jenner, she was wrestling with these issues, was very forthright about them. And although Caitlyn Jenner has a lot of privilege in the transgender narrative, we should understand that being transgendered is not the same as being a woman. Okay? And what Rachel Dolezal is saying is that she's black. Right. She's not saying that she's, you know, trying to make some move or identifies in some particular way. She's saying she is that. And when you look at the history, deception is an important piece of this. When you look at her lawsuit against Howard, when you look at the complications with her family, when you look at the deception with the NAACP and with the local law enforcement regarding these sort of strange charges of being victimized by hate mail, those things sort of undermine a straightforward narrative about how and why she's identifying with blackness. And again, you know, I don't want to disrespect any of the discourses around Caitlyn Jenner, and I think we should respectfully keep them separate. Absolutely. Intersectionality is not about conflating all identities. It's about celebrating all different
identities. Not to mention that trans identities aren't perpetrated on deception, which I think a lot of people assume that they are. These are people who are coming out. They are giving their truth. They are saying, this is who I am. Rachel Dolezal would have never come out. She got caught up.
Mm. We have another. This is a tweet from Ron. He says, my wife is white and grew up in North Philadelphia. She doesn't call herself black because she understands the politics behind it.
Absolutely. That there's a history, that there's a culture that you don't necessarily have full access to. And again, it's about respect at some very basic level. And so if there are questions about your own racial identity, you can say, I don't feel white without saying I am black.
Again, it's the issue of whiteness here. It really is. And how whiteness flattens out ethnic identity. And so there are plenty of white folks over the long course of history who have grown up with black folks, who have been in black families, who have raised black children, who have been engaged in the movement. They don't cross the line that Rachel Dolezal has crossed because of, it is baseline respect, but also it's a deeper understanding of what blackness is. And it isn't just about genetic categories. Mm-hmm. It's about a set of experiences, mm-hmm. history, culture, and it's also about the consequences of the socially constructed nature of race in America.
She did quote, this was, I think, last week from W.E.B. Du Bois talking about, I'm sorry about that, I just keep going back to these things, saying, encouraging her critics to maybe think about W.E.B. Du Bois, who said that race is usually biological, always cultural. And she seems to want to make this distinction. I mean, she talks about the sort of being inflicted with her sort of biology as opposed to and choosing something else. Do you want to weigh in on that?
I mean, I get it. We should all be pushing back about some biological fact of race. We should. But again, my question is about this culture that she claims she's so seated in. I don't know the whole story, but how? When?
Yeah, I just, you know, again, it's when you look at the work of Du Bois, you know, it's very clear that Du Bois articulates the pain of the black experience. I mean, has she looked at the chapter entitled The Sorrow Songs? Has she looked closely at Souls of Black Folk and look at what he's wrestling? Du Bois was a privileged, light-skinned black person trained at Harvard who was wrestling with identifying with the more oppressive experiences that, as he saw them, in the South. And look at the work that he did. You want to talk about work?
Right. Mm.
Look at the work that Du Bois did in The Philadelphia Negro. All right, one of the greatest sociological works done in the history of sociology. That is work. That's a black person doing that kind of work. So to use Du Bois to try to rectify what, again, I think is a fairly cosmetic move towards blackness, I think, again, is disrespectful. And you mm-hmm. see that time and time again in the narratives that she's talking about in the media.
And it also seems convenient, right? Because reportedly this is someone who took the position that white people had no place in the Black Lives Matter movement. This is someone who called out her student who identifying as Latino, saying, well, you don't look Latino. Like, this is before she got outed. And so in this moment, now you want to call on Du Bois as a rationale for your own behavior? It doesn't work that way.
And that's Yaba Blay joining us with James Peterson, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Ken from Germantown to join us. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I have a couple of friends who were born in Egypt, or their parents were born in Egypt. They were raised in the U.S., They identify as black. Their parents raised them as black. They joined black fraternities. And at the same time, they say they are Caucasian. I'm just wondering how, you know, that's different from Rachel, in the sense that the suggestion somehow that Caucasians can't be white, or it sounds like whiteness is different than Caucasian. I'm just trying to get your perspective on it.
I think that, again, that has to do with the ways in which the country has come to define race over the years and how that has become, you know, it's changed over time. Egyptians weren't always considered white in the same ways that Jews weren't and Italians weren't. But again, for the political implications of race over time, Egyptians are now considered white on paper. Is their experience white?
Mm.
those are questions we have to ask.
These are these boxes it that is. Don't exactly work.
And also the
very
power
well.
Of how race operates in our society, that our society and institutions will ascribe racial categories in order to allocate certain kinds of resources. And so you can see that shift over time. Black folks, and the racial category setup has never been the same in the census. It changes every 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And you can check all the boxes, can't you?
Exactly. And unfortunately, those shifts reflect for us the ways in which race is used to allocate resources in our society. It's part of the sort of what I call the consequences of the social construction of race.
Do you think there's certain advantages that she got by calling herself black? I mean, is there any way even to know that? We talk about white privilege.
Sure.
Was there black privilege for her?
It's tricky. In the world that she's constructing for herself, identifying as black gives her a certain kind of authenticity and legitimacy for her to say this can be a part of the movement or this can't, or you can come speak in my university about these issues or can't, or you can identify as this or not. So it gave her a sort of micro privilege within the world in which she constructed for herself. But again, that to me undermines what the long history of race is. It undermines this idea that race has always been used to allocate resources in our society, and it has often been used to deny resources to black folks. So she's inverting that in some ways that undermines and disrespects the narrative she's trying to claim.
Sure, and I think we have to also acknowledge that privilege is relative, right? So in the space of blackness, yes, she was privileged. She didn't call it white privilege, but others may have called it light skin privilege, for example. Especially being a black woman, right? That's a whole nother conversation around colorism and phenotype and the ways in which we are assessed based upon how we look. And even as a black woman who is a professor of Africana studies, she occupied space. As a professor of Africana studies, she occupied a space of privilege and authority as a so-called black woman. And so, again, it's this conversation for me about how is it that you are helping if you are, because you keep saying, I've done the work, I've had the experience, but ultimately you continue to marginalize the very people who you are identifying with.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Yaba Blay. She's an Africana Studies professor at Drexel University, wrote a book just 2 years ago called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race. In fact, was a guest on Radio Times. James Peterson has been a guest a number of times on Radio Times, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, also the host of a podcast here at WHYY called The Remix. Much more after this very short break. I see lots of phone calls and lots of comments as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with James Peterson and Yaba Blay. A few people had ever heard of Rachel Dolezal last week, until last week when she was outed by her parents, who said she was white. She'd been passing as black. She'd been active in civil rights. In fact, headed up the Spokane NAACP until she resigned this week. Melissa Harris-Perry interviewed her last night on MSNBC. And let's listen to just a small portion of that interview.
What does it mean to you to assume the mantle, the identity of blackness?
Well, it means several things. First of all, it means that I have really gone there with the experience in terms of being a mother of two black sons and really owning what it means to experience and live blackness. And so that's one aspect. Another aspect would be that I, from a very young age, felt spiritual, visceral, just very instinctual connection with black is beautiful, just the black experience, and wanting to celebrate that. And I didn't know how to articulate that as a young child. I mean, in kindergarten or whatever, like, you know, you don't have words for what's going on, but certainly that was shut down. I mean, I was socially conditioned to not own that and to be limited to whatever biological identity was thrust upon me and narrated to me. And so I kind of felt pretty awkward a lot of times with that.
Can she own it?
Again, the language is that not white privilege? Black identity is not for you to own. Like, you can do all of those things. You can have this visceral, spiritual, whatever connection to the Black is Beautiful moment in the Black history without trying to own it. Can't you just appreciate it and move on?
And what you're saying, and we have to get to the bottom line, which is this is about white privilege.
It is. And
this is perhaps a very good example.
This is a great example of what it sounds like. Because I take some issue with her using her children in these narratives. I mean, it doesn't strike me as being appropriate to use the narrative of your children, who are really innocent in all of this, as a way of validating this proposition that you're making. But the discourse of ownership smacks of white privilege in ways that I think her unawareness of it is just striking.
Mm-hmm. Let me read an email from Deborah. She says, if being able to claim yourself as Black has to do with your experiences going through life as a Black person, then what would you say about a biracial woman, let's say, who was able to pass as white all of her life? Since she did not experience life as a Black person, can she still claim herself as such? Who is the arbiter, the gatekeeper? Who is Black and who is white? I mean, in many ways, that's exactly what your book was about.
Yeah, those are the questions that we continue to answer, but it's also about us centralizing that within the complete racial history of this country about why these things are possible or not. For many of the people in the book, they do claim Blackness, but they also don't run away from their whiteness or their otherness. And so they identify their Blackness with a particular experience, but they all acknowledge that they may not walk through the world, let's say, as I do, but their connection to Blackness actually is beyond that.
Yeah,
as well.
Also, being biracial has its own set of experiences and challenges. This nation, as so many people who are biracial, have spoken of and talked about. And so I don't think that question necessarily impacts what we're talking, because she's not claiming a biracial identity.
No.
She's claiming a Black identity.
Right.
And so it's about respecting people's experiences. Mind you, the Black community checks Black folk who disassociate from Black experiences all day, every day. Okay, see
yes.
Don Lemon,
yes.
See Clarence Thomas.
Yes.
See, I mean, these are to act as if that Blackness is not being policed by Black folks is absurd. I don't want to engage in that because I don't want to police Blackness. That's not really what I'm here to do. But the Black community does that regularly and sometimes viciously. One quick thing too, that the humor piece is really, really important, because we shouldn't mistake humor for just being humor. Because a lot of times in the Black experience, where you see humor most pronounced is where it's reflecting on and fingering the jagged edge of pain in American society.
Is it time to get beyond Black and white? I mean, you know, it's 2015, and going back to your book, Yabba Boy, I mean, this is multicultural mixed bag of race and identity and ethnicity.
Yeah, but we're still having a racist and racialized experience. Like, it's interesting, a lot of people want us to move beyond these boxes, but these boxes still have implications for our lived experience.
These two boxes.
Absolutely. I mean, and not to mention beyond the kind of personal prejudice and racism, we have to talk about institutional and systemic racism. And those things are founded on these boxes in a particular way. So as much as we would like to move beyond them, there's so many other things that would have to happen for us to be able to do that.
You want
to
weigh in on that?
Yeah, we'll because I'm less and less interested with the personal experiences of race and racism, and much more interested in dismantling the systems of racism and white supremacy. And so this is where we have to think about the social construction of whiteness and the social construction of Blackness. Those are very real things. When you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, when you look at the continuing sort of police brutality in our communities, those things play out along those social constructions. That's what we've got to stay focused on.
Let me get, looks like Renit from Allentown to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air. Do we have him? Yes.
Your guests have raised some really solid points about race being a social construction and optional ethnicity as a privilege of whiteness or being white. But I wonder if there's a broader moral theme here that we haven't addressed. And basically, it's the issue that we're judging this woman for being a deviant. She's crossed the moral lines of race that are uncomfortable to both groups. Racial policing, after all, goes both ways, as Professor Peterson mentioned.
Right.
I remember an episode of All in the Family where Archie Bunker gets a visit from Sammy Davis Jr. And he turns to Sammy Davis and says, you know, it's bad enough being Black, but why the hell would you want to be Jewish? So the point is that we're judging her for choosing the most denigrated status in our society. Aren't we kind of judging her for that, and nobody's really mentioning this?
Well, it looks like Yabba Blay wants to respond to your comment.
Please.
I don't know if that's why we're judging her as much as we're judging the kind of circus that she's created around blackness and the ways in which she's been deceptive in doing so. I think there might be some broader conversation. Again, these questions with passing, particularly
Absolutely.
In this quote-unquote reverse, like
Absolutely.
Why would you want to do that? But I don't know, and I'm speaking for myself,
sure.
I don't know that that's where the black community's quote-unquote judgment is necessarily coming from, as much
well,
as it's about making a mockery in a certain way of who we are.
That we are judging her, and I see this in the academic community, I'm an academic myself, is that when there have been so many efforts in trying to understand this argument from all different perspectives, one of the narratives that I hear is the pathology narrative, that this woman is sick, that there's something wrong with her. So I think that we are labeling her on so many levels that ultimately she's just this you know, high-end deviant.
Well, you know, let me just check. You said the word deviant before, and I scribbled it down. I just have to say on this show, no one has called her a deviant, and we haven't psychologized or given her any kind of diagnosis or label. So we're trying to avoid that as much as we can. But, Renee, let me just see if James Peterson wants to respond.
Yeah, I think I'm not a psychologist, so I don't want to psychoanalyze her. And I understand that there has been a lot of judgment.
There has.
The judgment is based on the pain of the history of the black experience, and the ways in which an appropriation in this manner of black culture seems to fly in the face of that particular history. And so the deception, the lawsuits, the sort of obscured family history, the different lies that she's told at different points, the ways in which she's tried to represent her blackness through social media are all things that have become fodder for the kind of critique and judgment of the black community. But I think the caller and people like Melissa Harris Perry are right that we have to be careful about judgments based upon genetics and
sure.
judgments of race that flatten out what race can be and what it's supposed to be about. But folks have a right, especially black women, I think, have a right to be upset about this kind of appropriation because it does seem to mock the history that she's claiming to identify with.
You agree with that, Yabba Black?
Absolutely. And again, it's that privilege, that fluidity. So if you've been black since such time, then why did you sue Howard as a white woman? Like, you get to pick and choose when this blackness works for you. And we don't have that option.
You've been monitoring the Twitterverse, as we call it,
yes.
Pretty obsessively since this story broke. What is your takeaway? I mean, our caller talked about people really judging her and calling her a deviant, but what has been the response online?
It's been voracious. Just check the hashtag, particularly check the Rachel Dolezal memoir hashtags. Which really sort of gets at some of the issues. You've seen some fragmentation within the black community because you're seeing, and I think it is a split along gender lines, you're seeing some black men come to the defense of Rachel Dolezal, and I think Yaba can speak more to the sort of light-skinned privilege along gender lines that I think this narrative sort of falls within as well. And you see a lot of black women outraged, terms like livid, anger, frustration. And part of that's because think about what black women have to deal with in this society. Not just about hair and their body type, but the ways in which those things are imitated and produced and reproduced in the media. It is a challenging existence. And so for someone to undermine that by sort of appropriating it in what looks like a flippant way,
mm-hmm.
I think reads as being disrespectful. Social media has been all over this from the beginning.
And absolutely. For those of us who are, you know, more activist minded as well, it's this idea that we are online actually having to defend ourselves with black men who are ready to defend this woman when black men are assassinated in this country, we are on the front lines defending black manhood and black masculinity. But we have to actually create hashtags. We have to say hashtags, say her name. We have to put you in a position to recognize us. It's interesting, this young woman, Jaderica
Becton,
out of McKinley, who was dragged by the police officer. Her Instagram, she says, "Justice for me." She has to ask us to give her justice, right? So black women are out here saying, look at us. We are having this experience too. Are you going to be on the front lines for us when it goes down for us? But you're so quick to cape for this woman, right, who is white, who has made a mockery of our own identity, and still you want us to find some reason to empathize with her. It's a slap in the face.
This is a really awkward segue here because Melissa Harris Perry talked to her about her hair, and much has been made of her hair. What should we make of that whole discussion, Yababai?
I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that, hair is so intertwined with our identity, particularly when you talk about the politics of identity for black women. The very hairstyles that she's wearing that have authenticated her blackness are the hairstyles that we've been told to tame in order to assimilate into broader mainstream culture. So she can go and talk about going natural and wearing hair in these ways and wearing these braids, but for so many other black women, we have to not do that in order to be successful.
And it's infuriating for black women because you see some black men saying, well, black women dye their hair blonde, they straighten their hair, you know, why are they why are we not supporting Rachel Dolezal? And that is an extreme complication because black women have to maneuver around the politics of their hair for their whole lives. It's not a choice. It's something that they have to do. And the survival of that and the wrestling with that and the celebration of that is a very, very important part of the black woman's experience.
And let me just reintroduce everybody. That's James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, also Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a regular contributor to MSNBC and thegrio.com, also the host of the WHYY Newsworks podcast called The Remix. Also with us is Yaba Belay. She's Africana Studies Professor at Drexel University, wrote a book called One Drop, Shifting the Lens on Race, and she was a consulting producer to the CNN series called Black in America. And we are talking about the curious case of Rachel Dolezal and all the questions that it raises about race and racial identity. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Ahmed from, it looks like Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Ahmed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I just wanted to say, talk about it from an advocacy perspective. And, you know, what I find deplorable about what Dolezal did is that she could have and should have done so much good as an advocate for a minority group while herself openly being a member of a majority. Because I think that no small part what changes minds, changes policy, gets results is when members of a majority, in this case white majority, advocate proudly with and for the minority. And I just want to add that I, as a Muslim in America, and you know, probably a member of the most hated minority group in America at the moment, applaud anyone from the majority or anyone who's not Muslim who stands up with me for my rights, because I think that's necessary for all rights to be propagated fully. And what Dolezal did, instead, she chose a moronic and duplicitous pathway in lieu of a harder and truer road. And unfortunately, she set back advocacy for all of us. And that's where, you know, we have to remember that as an employee and later as the head of the Spokane chapter of the NAACP, it's not just a civil rights group, an equal rights group, it's an advocacy group as well. And in doing so, I think she set back advocacy for everybody, and she did it deliberately, which I find deplorable.
Well, Ahmed, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. I know both of our guests want to respond.
He's James. Absolutely right. A hugely missed opportunity. What's often lost in conversations about alliances and the whole ally movement is the very simple fact that as a straight black male, I am most powerful in identifying with women of color and sexual assault issues. I got to talk to the men who are perpetrating rape and sexual assault. My voice has more power in those situations. Same time, same thing. Unfortunately, sometimes we can hear things better from people who look like us or sound like us, and that is the leverage that allies have to make. So it's a missed opportunity. It's exactly right here.
Absolutely, and I think she had an opportunity to model what it looks like to be an advocate of the majority for social justice issues. And it's just interesting to me, particularly when she falls back on this argument of being of the human race. I think social justice work is human work. And so I think she had an opportunity to model that.
Do you think, I mean, we're also out of time here, but do you think, I mean, is it too late? Can she now say, okay, folks, I'm white and...
That's a great question.
It is a great question, but you know what's, again, further interesting about how this white privilege works is that we're going to continue to hear her name. She's going to continue to sit on couches. She's going to get a six-figure book deal. There might be even a movie. She's profiting off of blackness. We don't.
Well, on that note, I knew this would be a good conversation because we called you two up to join us on Radio Times, and indeed it was much more to talk about. Yaba Blay, thank you so much for joining us. And James Peterson, thank you for joining us as well. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And we did post some comments and come-ons, I should say, on social media to join this conversation. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.